I announced at breakfast this morning that this is one of two sessions that are, they are so interrelated that what we really have is a coin and it has two sides. And
okay, this will be a session on what I call the last days, and it won't be on a session, are we in the last days? I don't know any more about that than the people I'll be talking about. But I do invite your comments and responses to this. For one reason, quite selfishly, it's an area where I'm doing a good deal of research now. And my editor was happy when he found out I was going to Holden Village, because we want really to know what people are thinking, what they're interested in, and where there is the need and the opportunity really for, you know, for more books and more work. And I'm only too happy to do that. And sometimes it takes roughly from about, let's say now, until the book is done, in about 2 years for the whole process to get done. And so you sort of have to anticipate ahead of time what are going to be some of the problems and some of the questions that are coming up. And so I would be only too happy to get your response to some of the ideas and some of the positions that I'm going to be taking here. And also, I want to sort of give it a focus, not just, you know, tell some interesting stories and you know, some interesting, amusing anecdotes and so on, although that's always fun. And one of the things I hope Holden will do again, as it has done, is just simply have storytelling time. We talked about that the other day, and how nice that is. But anyway, one way in which I want to sort of organize the material is to call this the end times, and then sort of colon, and then, you know, what does it matter? And that comes directly out of a personal experience, because I like to do adult forums, and in that great Lutheran womb of the North known as Minneapolis, there is a great opportunity for doing adult forums. And what I found last fall was, when I was doing an adult forum at Central Lutheran on the on this particular subject, and I was making the usual academic, snide, sarcastic little remarks, isn't that held in, you know, really isn't he just sort of gauche and you know, a little bit silly and all the rest of these things. And in fact, where was it? I was making something about, commenting that some Cobra helicopter had been, you know, that had been predicted in the Gospel of John. And I was making, you know, some, as I say, ivory tower kind of remarks. And I remember very well, in fact, she used to be on the board here, Mrs. Peterson, got up and simply said, you know, what does it matter? Does it really make any difference that Hal Lindsey says some, you know, kind of funny, probably some unusual things? Does it really make a difference as to what we sort of believe so far as the end times or the, you know, the last days are concerned? And that bothered me a great deal, and especially since it came, you know, right from the audience, and not just something that I sort of dreamed up myself, because people are interested. And so I've been thinking a great deal about doing more on this, and what I found with the various adult forums and in reading and talking with other people is that among those in the mainstream of American church life, by mainstream I mean Lutheran, Presbyterian, Episcopal, Methodist, you know, UCC and so on, Baptist, that there is a great deal of confusion, and a lot of people have a great number of questions about this. And it's not that, though, you know, my research is going to be able to set them straight once and for all. This is only sort of a small beginning, and I can really, I see myself basically as somebody who can raise certain questions and point to certain kinds of interpretations with this. But I think it does make a difference, you know, in this question, what does it matter? It really does matter what we believe, because it has implications not only for ourselves, but personally in our own lives, individual lives, but it has implications also so far as our public, our social life is concerned. And right away we think of Secretary James Watt on this, and I'll be saying a few things about that, but I don't want to make the, you know, the whole focus just on that either. But that's just one indication of where I'll be going with this. And I'll be going through what I see as the evidences of a new surge of interest in the end times or the last days, some of the materials I have, some of the teachings that are going on, and spend a little more than a little bit of time on one of the more, I think, influential books today, Mary Stuart Ralph's When Your Money Fails. Does anybody know this particular one, When Your Money Fails? Well, that means I've got you know, work to do here when I see that. And I'll be glad to talk about that at some length, and then give my own particular answer to, you know, what does it matter? Because sometimes here I don't get as directly involved in some of the things as I should, and I would like to give my own opinions. And then I would certainly welcome your response. I'd welcome your response anytime to any of the material that I'm talking about. And for some of you who haven't been in my sessions before, you know that you might not know that I talk very fast. And I won't explain that or justify that or rationalize it anymore, you know, about leopard spots and things like that. Okay. So I want to talk about the last days within the framework of what does it matter, and argue that it does matter a good deal, that this just isn't sort of an interesting doctrine that we can sort of, you know, put out there and, you know, like we have here, and put the doctrine out there and look at it for a while, and everybody walk around it and go, ooh and ah, isn't that nice, and we can walk away from it, having seen it, you know, from its in its many different dimensions. But I think it does make a significant difference in our lives and the way in which we respond to that which we call, you know, our committed Christian faith. All right. As I said before, it would be very easy to, you know, do sort of a clever, quippy, sarcastic sort of thing about this, and everybody would go along with some new chuckles about Hal Lindsey's latest horror stories or whatever goes along with this. But I have to tell just one. Obviously, I'm not perfect, so I have to tell just one. Not about Hal Lindsey. But this came to me because I was doing this last summer also at an elder hostel, and somebody who had been in one of the sessions sent me this particular story. I didn't bring the actual physical evidence along, but it wasn't interesting. She had been going shopping for potatoes, and she wasn't really thinking about the end times when she was shopping for potatoes, but it happened on the sack, and it happened to be from Idaho, some Idaho potato. It's no surprise that, you know, you find potatoes from Idaho. Just, you know, is the Pope Catholic, or do they raise apples in Chelan or something, you know? So they have, and it said on the advertisement, on the bag itself, besides, you know, 10 pounds of grade A or whatever they, however they grade potatoes, it said this: for authentic book reporting Christ's visit to ancient America after his resurrection. You didn't know that Christ visited ancient America after his resurrection. You stop to think about the implications that, you know, write so-and-so a place. I'm not going to, in fact, I don't even have the address here. So that's the sort of thing that I want to try to avoid, because some of that is, you know, so far out, in a way almost so bizarre that it really doesn't make much, we don't have to take this seriously. But I think some of the other more, there are some serious implications, and what has happened is that concern for and, well, not only interest in, but concern for and worry over the end times has increased, and as it's spread right into, you know, the mainstream churches, as I've suggested. And some of the people whom I respect a great deal, some people whom I have the greatest admiration and respect for their judgment in their insights, tell me that they believe that we are now living in what they call a state of high expectancy, that something like the end times really are here. And as I say, if this were, you know, somebody, you know, repent, America, repent, painting this on some, you know, rock as you make the corner and on a country road or something, or something else like that, or on somebody on Broadway and 50th, America is doomed or something else like that, you know, you wouldn't probably get very excited, but because that's been going on for a long, long time. But it is increasing now, and furthermore, it's being increased because some people are beginning to realize that we are approaching the year 2000. And if there's one thing with end times or last days, it's the influence and the impact and the attraction of numerology on this. 2000 has a nice sort of neat fit to it. It isn't anything sort of, you know, leftover. There aren't any leftover things, but you like to think that something as dramatic as 2000 will really be something important. And hence they believe that that would be a good time for the world to end. The idea adds credibility to those who are looking for some sort of crack up really in the, you know, in the late great planet Earth. And so they like the symmetry and the neatness that goes with this. I should have brought it, but I've got one of Jerry Falwell's pamphlets who says it's going to be the year 2000 or, you know, or thereabouts. And the only problem with that is, you know, what do you mean by thereabouts? some difficult. All right, now, first of all, you know, what kind of evidence is there? What kind of evidence is there? As a historian, I like to look at evidence because I'm aware of people who write materials, you know, as they say, who write materials and make statements, you know, without fear and without research. I like to avoid doing things without fear and having done some research. So what kind of, I've got about seven or eight items here, I think, seven, which would indicate, you know, the growing public interest in this. And and then we'll look at, you know, what it all adds up to. First of all, from the 1970s, and it's amazing when you stop to think of it, the most popular nonfiction bestseller in all of the 1970s was Lindsay's The Late Great Planet Earth. Over 15 million copies were sold. 15 million copies in the 1970s. The New York Times did an analysis of all the bestsellers of the 1970s. It outsold Dr. Spock, for instance. And you'd think that it outsold all the recipe books. It outsold all the marriage manuals. It outsold all the traditional bestsellers, you know, in nonfiction. Not all together, I mean, when you put them all together, but it was an indication that it was, you know, it had really caught on. In fact, you can almost always tell when a fundamentalist book like this is catching on, because it'll be taken over by a major publisher. He had started off with a Grand Rapids, Michigan publisher, Zondervan, and all of a sudden it caught on. And when Bantam Books take something, you know, that means it's hit the big leagues. That's the major leagues when Bantam, and you can buy it at your local, what is it out here, Safeway? It's Red Owl in Minnesota. Safeway here? Okay, anyway, when you can buy it there, you don't find, you know, Martin Luther's Christian Liberty next door, and next to it in the bookstore, in the book racks. Okay, 15 million copies of Hal Lindsey's book. People, you know, like researchers, get excited when they see things like that. Secondly, as I've already suggested, we have the uproar, which hasn't really let up at all, starting about a year and a half ago when Secretary of Interior James Watt told the House Interior Committee, "I do not know how many future generations we can count on before the Lord returns." No, the close quote. All right. Now, Watt has denied that this meant that we should not be greatly concerned with the long-range protection of natural resources. But I would agree with Professor William Martin, who's sort of a James Watt watcher here, and we need a lot of those, but I would agree with Professor James Martin of Rice. One is hard-pressed to understand why Watt raised the issue if that was not precisely what he meant. Why bring it in unless that is precisely what he had in mind? I think there's something to be said for that. And Watt is what we call a pre-tribulation rapture person or commitment committed on that, and I'll explain later what that means. All right. Third, and here's where it gets into, you know, what does it matter so far as public policy is concerned? We have, since with the new administration in Washington, those who are committed to what I tried to call in the book in 1981, the new Christian right. And there are several who are in positions of high policymaking, authority in Washington at that time. And here's where it really does matter. For instance, one of the teachings you see in the premillennial interpretation of the last days is that there must be a Russian-led attack on Israel before the last days itself can actually come. All right, say you've got a Secretary of State or a high-up person who is in the State Department, who is also a premillennialist. They would obviously want a Russian-led, attack on Israel, because that would help hasten the last days. See, is that clear? As John would say, can you feel that? I haven't heard John for 2 years, and it's good to hear that. But anyway, that would be one particular worry of my part as to what does it matter. Or you take another one. As we'll see when we get to Mary Stuart Ralph's book here, she truly and sincerely believes, that the last days are here, that the countdown to Armageddon has stopped, and that the Antichrist is now on Earth, and that his headquarters are in Brussels, in Belgium, at the headquarters of the European Economic Community. Sometimes we call this the common market. And therefore, if that's the case, then wouldn't there be some, and if the economic community in Europe is part of the Antichrist policy, then how could somebody who was a premillennialist try to do anything except stop or somehow prevent or follow up or clog the work of, the European Economic Community? Because the whole scheme with the pre-tribulation rapture people is we can't really get the end days until some of these other things literally and factually have to have taken place before that. So it does make a difference as to what I'm trying to suggest on it. So I'll talk more about the European Economic Community later, because some of it is a little unusually. Just one sort of preview of what we'll be talking about there. They have a huge computer, as many great enterprises do, and the employees laughingly refer to it as the beast. But what's happened with, if you know your Revelation 13:18 with the mark of the beast, this is now taken to be literally as the beast is here. I've had some trouble with computers, but I don't like to think of them as beasts. Ours up on our floor is usually, as they say, down, and that doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad or anything else. Okay. Now, that would be another sign. A fourth sign, really, of the growing popularity of the people who preach this kind of end times would be the increasing huge financial intake of those we call the TV evangelists or the televangelists on the tube, who are talking about the imminent end times, and they are making big bucks. Let me just give you a couple of statistics, and I'll limit it just to Pat Robertson with the 700 Club. When I wrote the other book, Robertson was bringing in about $1 million a week. That's not a year, folks, that's $1 million at Virginia Beach, Virginia, a week. And that was in 1980, the last time I did any serious study on this. I was at a conference in Wheaton College this spring, and this was Richard Ostling, who was a religion editor for Time, a respected, you know, dependable scholar, somebody who I certainly respect in his factuality. And Ostling said that now, 3 years later, Robertson is bringing in $100 million a year. It's gone up from 52 or so on to $100 million a year. Now that's from the religion editor of Time, and I quote that as not only evidence that I've done my research, but it is much more important. It's an indication of how much money people are getting for those who for those who are preaching this sort of thing. Now you say, well, if the end times are coming, why send in any money? I mean, if it's just a matter of this coming, you know, why do this? It's just like one reporter who did a piece on profile on Robertson for Harper's. Went down to visit the new headquarters in Virginia Beach, and when he was walking in, he noticed that some trees were being planted, and Robertson at that time had predicted the world was going to end in about 2 years. And then he went in to ask Robertson, you know, how long will it take before these trees maturate? And Robertson said, 50 years. And he said, you know, why bother? I mean, because of that. But anyway, Robertson is making big bucks because of this. Let me give you just a couple of ideas of what he's talking about here. He finds in the Bible a scenario like this. Maybe in 1983, the USSR will join with Iran, Libya, and Ethiopia in a war against Israel. And that really is crucial, you see, to the whole scheme here, because in order for the last days to come, the Jews had to return to the homeland. That is, you know, essential to the whole scheme. And now that Israel is there, that's taken, especially when it got to be an independent nation, remember in 1948, that's taken as proof that the scheme, you see, of the end times is not only gradually but now rapidly being encouraged, and or not encouraged but materializing. And they take this proof text from Jeremiah 29:14. I will bring you back to the place from where I sent you into exile. And therefore, now that the Jews are back, and now that the Jews are having all that trouble with their neighbors, Iran, Libya, Ethiopia, and all the rest of these things, this is proof, you see, that the world is approaching this sort of thing. All right. And that therefore, since this is important, and John talked about hermeneutics in the first hour, and I like to underline that here, they therefore believe that they are right in the way in which they interpret Scripture, because they say it is being factually fulfilled in history itself. This isn't some sort of scheme that some ivory tower dreamer has sort of floated out on us, but now it is actually being fulfilled itself. It's right here, and therefore we can believe in this kind of proof text analysis, in which we can go and take one verse from Zechariah and a couple of verses from Daniel, tack on a chapter or two from Revelation. They wouldn't say that, obviously, and I'm being sarcastic when I say that, but anyway, they would say that those of us who are in the mainstream are wrong in the way in which we interpret Scripture, because it's being full history, you know, it's being accurately and literally fulfilled, and therefore, you know, we should join the bandwagon ourselves. All right. Now, one other thing is significant with Robertson on this, and he's preaching. You wonder about why does he call for people to send in money? Okay, besides obviously wanting to keep going, he also believes that the end times won't come, the Battle of Armageddon won't come, until the gospel has been preached to all the world. You can find some proof text for that. And that therefore, the more money you send in, the more equipment through satellites, TV, and all the rest that 700 Club and Jim Baker's PTL Club and the others will be able to have to broadcast the gospel. And therefore, once the gospel has been preached to all the world, then the last times will come. And so the end time is waiting for this to happen. So therefore, the idea is to speed up the timetable by doing this sort of thing. And people send in their money. And I don't want to get going into the whole TV preacher thing, but I think it's another indication that something is going on here. Not only with Robertson, but other TV preachers are finding that the same themes are very, very popular. I found Kenneth Copeland, for instance, who's making progress in this direction. Or another one who's come really out of the blue in the last year or so is Jimmy Swaggart. Swaggart's found other ways of raising money. I don't know if you remember that he found a rich widow. That's one way of, really rich widow, of doing things, and has found this to be quite profitable. And others, you can mention Jack Van Imp, Oral Roberts, and so on. These people who are preaching, this kind of eschatology or doctrine of the last things, obviously are finding, people are willing to support them. And also, sort of sixth year, there are sort of what I call traveling slideshow programs and spokesmen. who go around more or less on the local or on the state or regional level, like, you know, Lamb and Lion would be the name of one, and I think you can understand really why they would use that particular title. Or the Second Coming Incorporated World Prophecy Ministry, they also have a large ministry, and it's continuing to grow. All right. But the one I would want to concentrate today on and do some, you know, detailed in-depth study would be the title I've had on the board here, Mary Stuart Ralph's When Your Money Fails. And she raises some very interesting questions that pertain directly to this matter of, you know, what does it matter? How does it matter itself? And it is probably, she's obviously, since none of you have even heard of the book, to say nothing have read it, moving in circles which are outside the mainstream. But what I found, and this is why I decided to take a look at this in some depth, was that people, for instance, those I was talking to, not only in Central Lutheran, but some of the other congregations in Minneapolis, where we did the adult forums, were finding that they would go to work and didn't have answers for their friends who were saying that who had read the Mary Stuart Ralph book and were saying the end times are here. And those of my friends from Central or the other ones, Prince of Peace in Burnsville and so on, simply didn't have the answers for this, and that therefore there was you know, a great deal of difficulty and a great deal of curiosity as to, you know, what's going on. All right, now. What I want to get at next, then, given the fact that, you know, I think the movement is growing, you know, then the next question becomes, you know, why? Is there any kind of convincing evidence or proof? What is the factual case for believing this? Obviously, people from the very beginning, and you find this directly in the Gospels, as we well know, people believe in the end times. Paul told people not, you know, young people not to get married because that's in 1 Corinthians 7, is it? It's in 1 Corinthians, anyway. Paul was giving advice about not getting married because the end times were coming. Okay, so that's nothing new, and it's gone all the way through, up through history. One of the best books, if you're ever interested in following this through all the way, is called, it's by Norman Cohen, C-O-H-N, called The Pursuit of the Millennium. It's a marvelous book on what we call eschatological or end times thought in the Middle Ages. And when you got things like the Black Plague, for instance, or the Lisbon earthquake, or other things like this, what else could you believe but that this was, you know, the end times? Even some people, you know, like the San Francisco fire or the Tokyo earthquake or other things have always, you know, brought on this kind of new interest in eschatological thought. All right. Now, I think the end times has caught on because, and here we have to go into a little detailed doctrine, because of one of the foundational doctrines for those who believe, you know, that we're in the last days. And this is where we depart, or where they depart from the mainstream. But this is, you know, fundamental, and I'll outline the doctrine without editorial comment here on my part. They argue that this world is not the domain of God, but this domain belongs to Satan. This is Satan's world. The earth, therefore, is corrupting. The earth is mortal. The earth is the battleground and the arena where Satan does his thing. Satan, in a very real sense, sort of won at the fall. In my class last year, we went through this at great length in Milton's marvelous interpretation, you know, in Paradise Lost. And did Satan win? And there are those who say, yes, Satan won at that time. Okay. And then the question, and this is a question you asked, Joe, the other day, was, you know, why did God allow this to happen? Why did God, the almighty, you know, omniscient God of love and forgiveness, all that, why did God allow this to happen? And here's the premillennial interpretation. He allowed this to happen to demonstrate his almighty power, that once and for all, you see, he had the strength, and only he had the strength, to destroy Satan and all the angels and the legions and the followers who went with Satan. And that God wouldn't have proved that he was God if he had only defeated sort of a middle-level kind of adversary. You know, anybody could sort of do this, but you had to have a really powerful, you know, adversary, somebody who was almost equal in power with God, just that close away. Obviously, God has to win, but you can't have just an ordinary sort of person come along like Pahuka. You know, I'm going to give some examples from history a little away. All right. So, since the world is Satan's and all the rest, they believe this, and this is so fundamental to the whole thing. Both the moral and the economic, the living, social, all the conditions in this world inevitably have to continue to deteriorate. That's just fundamental, always. The general direction, the flow, the quality of this life must continue to deteriorate. It must grow more corrupt, more evil, more dangerous, more frightening. The world is, in other words, getting worse, and it's getting worse at an increasingly rapid time. The escalation, the rate of velocity is increasing. It isn't just 1, 2, 3, 4, but it's 1, 2, 4, 8, you know, 16, 32, and all the way up to, I used to know all those things, memorize them all the way up to 1,000 something or whatever it is. All right. But that's basic to this. All right. Now, therefore, you see, they look at the direction of world history today, socially, economically, morally, all the rest of these things, and say, here is the proof that our interpretation is right. They've got, you know, by their side, they've got the interpretation, they've got the facts. And there is, I have to say, you know, some very, I'm not personally persuaded, but they have some very compelling evidence that one, no matter how you slice it, have to take very seriously with us. Now, let me go through just one or two lists of the kinds of evidence that they use to prove that the world is growing, growing worse. And I want to take your jury follows, and I won't go into great detail on this, but I just want to list his 11 signs, actual physical signs that the world is growing worse. And he has proof texts for all these, and if you want these, I'll be glad to give you at the end of the period, but I won't take up time now to go through these. He has 11. First of all, increase of wars and rumor of wars. Second, increased extreme materialism. Third, a departure from the Christian faith. Fourth, overpopulation. Fifth, lawlessness. And sixth, I want to go into a little detail because you didn't know that Daniel 4 predicted computers. But it's, it's there. You're a computer, so you better watch it. With us, okay. This I want to go into a little detail because it ties in with what Ralph is going to say in a little while too. Daniel 12:4. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. And the way they think knowledge shall be increased, not only is that there an increase in education in this country and around the world, but that computers can increase our knowledge and can store it and can retrieve it much more quickly. In other words, the speed of knowledge now is much greater, and that therefore, since we have computers, that must mean what Daniel had in mind all the time with us. Okay. Don't press it too hard. All right. A seventh sign from Falwell's intense demonic activity. That is Satan worship cults, astrology, witch groups, and so on. And there certainly are, groups like that. And he gets, number eight, he gets political. The unification of the systems of one world. Those who fear, any kind of ecumenical movement, which he calls demonic. This would be the National Council of Churches, the World Council of Churches, Vatican II, Common Market, so on, things like that. Ninth, recent developments in Russia. 10th, recent developments in Israel. And 11th, the absence of dynamic, what he calls the absence of dynamic leadership. All right. Now, those would be his. Now, I thought you had something to clarify.
Oh, I was thinking that I was surprised that Falwell would say there's an absence of dynamic leadership couple of years.
He wrote this in 1981.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he wrote this in 1981, and he's somehow playing cozy with the White House, and sometimes he isn't on some things, and I'll be glad to talk about that, afterwards, because that's another story. All right. Now, other people take other signs, and of course, it's always fun out here to talk about Mount St. Helens, because it's close, and I remember the time I came out here in the summer of, whenever it was, 78, wasn't it, sure? And I saw all the ash in the, in the ditches when we came out of Moses Lake or wherever it was, and I was wondering, and the bus driver, told me what that was. But let me just give you one indication. I get a lot of interesting mail. Mailman always wonders, when I see some of this strange stuff and what's going on here. He thought I was just a history teacher up at St. Olaf, and I wasn't a closet, plotter or schemer or anything. But in the mail, the big trick in what we call junk mail, obviously, is to get you to turn to the second page. I mean, everybody looks at the first page to know what it is, but the trick is to get you to the second page, all right? On one of these Lamb and Lion or Lion or whatever it was, the front page was a huge picture of St. Mount Helens in full eruption. And I looked. And then below, in journalistic terms, it was absolutely superb, it was just right, they want you to turn the page. The big picture of Mount St. Helens, and the caption was, "Now that God has your attention." And isn't that a great way? I mean, just if you look at it just strictly from the standpoint of what a journalist wants to accomplish. Now that God has your attention, boy, I turned the page. I really did. And then I found that you could buy dried food for 7 years. For the Battle of Armageddon. And don't knock this, because this comes from a Lutheran in Portland, Oregon, whose name I'll mention after class, if any of you want to, you know, talk about that. But other signs here, and here's where the evidence, you know, has to be taken, I think, rather seriously. The increase in narcotics is another sign. The increase, for instance, the whole thing with herpes, with the VD epidemic, with explicit sex on cable television, with famine, pollution, with the energy crisis, you know, terrorism in the world, Sadat would be, you know, an example of this, political corruption, and so on. And above all, of course, there is always the danger of nuclear holocaust. And there are those who don't go along with the pre-tribulation rapture, obviously, who feel that the danger of nuclear destruction of life on this planet is, you know, is not only is no longer sort of a theoretical possibility out there, but is obviously very imminent. And so all of this together, you see, the evidence here is something that you have to take very seriously. It's not just, you know, those people over there who stand around on the street corners and say, America, repent any longer. What I'm trying to say is, obviously, that it has a great deal of compelling, a great compelling quality to it. And we have to look at it in, you know, with a great deal of seriousness and, I think, in sincerity. And this is what I would like to do. All right, now, I think the most compelling book and the one I want to talk about in some detail is the one which I have on the board here, Mary Stuart Ralph, When Your Money Fails. Some people think it's absolutely preposterous. Other people think that the evidence she has is a, you know, a remarkable collection of coincidences that have accumulated over the last few years. And others feel that some people have already made up their minds about the last days and simply go to the Bible to find appropriate proof texts. But what I want to try to suggest is, you know, why this book has appeared at this time, and, you know, really what does it all mean, and then what kind of a response can we make for this? All right. And to get at this, we have to look, first of all, at the traditional answer by mainline people, you know, we've heard all this before. Since the beginning of the Christian era, people have been predicting the end of time, that it's going to happen very, you know, quickly. Most of the popes have been considered the Antichrist at one time or another, and if you look very carefully in some Lutheran doctrines or some Lutheran teachings, in the articles of Schmalkald, you will find that it has not been repudiated officially from the Lutheran canon that the Pope is not the Antichrist. There you can actually read that into some of the teachings of the early Lutheran Church at that time. So, you know, Lutherans don't have much to brag about there. All right. Muhammad has been considered the Antichrist. Martin Luther himself has Napoleon, the Kaiser, Hitler, Mussolini, FDR, Khrushchev, the National Council of Churches, and worse out than my favorite, Henry Kissinger. has been, he wasn't my number one, but I don't think, you know, he seems pretty mellowed and laid back by now. All right, anyway. So there are those who argue, in other words, that since, you know, the Antichrist has been predicted and anybody you don't like, you know, like FDR has been considered the Antichrist, and some of you over here would, you know, you remember the bitter feeling about FDR and about Eleanor too, and, you know, the worst thing you could say for the bottom was something like that. So a lot of people are very skeptical about this, and Ralph is aware of this, and she goes into this in a great deal of detail, and this is what I want to go into in some detail. Now, she argues something like this. She argues that the Antichrist, the Battle of Armageddon, is here right now. This isn't something, you know, in the future. That the not only the countdown, but the actual process itself is here. The overture is over, we are well along. And that we only have to look at the evidence and read the signs in the ways which she argues are the ways which the Bible teaches. All right, now, what's her case? She starts off with three prophecies or prophetic fulfillments that she finds in our age. There are three crucial events that have taken place. First of all was the birth of Christ in 3 BC, okay, which fulfills, and then she's proof text Isaiah 9:6, Micah 5 to Isaiah 53, and so on. Okay, that's the first statement. The second one is the declaration of the nation of Israel in 1948. I mentioned it. The Jews have come home to their own homeland, as has been predicted. And I remember Billy Graham was very excited about that. This fulfills the Israel becoming an independent state. This fulfills Luke 21:24, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the time of Gentiles be fulfilled. That's the fulfillment of Luke 21:24. And third, well, that was 1948. Where are we now? And 1983. Third, the worldwide usage of the number 666. We used to sort of laugh about that when Bob Dylan got excited about it, you remember, a few years ago, and he thought, oh, Dylan is really freaked out this time, and so on. But now, according to Ralph, you know, it's here. Because if you take, you know, this is, if you, you know, the proof text here obviously is from Revelation 13:18. If you know that one, all right. What she finds is that the appearance of the mark of the beast, 666, is here, right here, now, and therefore we are in the third and final stage. You see, of the beginning of the Battle of Armageddon. She finds, for instance, that it is, you know, evident in many different places. I should have brought the book along. She has dozens of pages where she has photostyled copies of how the number 666 is showing up on credit cards, on bank statements, on little numbers that you find on merchandise, you know, everywhere across the board. Yeah, that the pages of proof that the Antichrist is now marking the people. And what the Antichrist, you see, will do is put his mark on everybody, and that means that they belong to him. That they belong to him rather than to Christ. This is the sign that will be made. And the headquarters for all this is the computer at the European Economic Community building in Brussels itself. The employees there call it the Beast, the Beast is doing this. That's the connection that she makes. All right, now, what's going to happen to all this according to this scenario? She said, eventually, everybody here will be given their own identification card and will have the mark of the beast on it. And that we will no longer have cash, we'll no longer have money when your money fails, because the surest way for Satan or the Antichrist, the beast, whatever you want to call it, the surest way to gain control over us, and this is a very sort of shrewd insight, is to control our money. What better way to control everybody and make them do exactly what you want than to control their money? I don't think any of us have to stop very long to figure out that one with this. And that with, you see, all the rise of computers and printouts and all the things now, to her, this is the factual, you know, historical evidence that all this is taking place. And that now that computers can do more, and, you know, with a few more years they'll be able to do even more, this can all be centralized. You can, you know, and for instance, are we close to this where you can order by just using your television or your radio and punching in your number, and you can order, you know, all these things? I'm having a hard enough time now with my budget. on a face-to-face basis, you know, think of what it'll be if I can spend, and all I have to do is do a few punches. At least now I have to go down and face the bank when they tell me, you know, your account has been overdrawn to the amount of. But all I have to do is make a few punches here and there, and, you know, zap, there will go any kind of self-restraint and everything that go along with it. But seriously, you know, since computers can, you know, handle all this, and handle it so quickly and instantly, see, the speed of knowledge will be increased. Daniel 12:4. That we'll all therefore get our credit card, our identifications, and that we will be taken over by this otherworldly force. And to her, you see, this is a fulfillment of prophecy. And then when you add to this all the business I talked about before with natural disasters, earthquakes, famine, with the decline of public morality around the country, not only around the country, but around the world, it adds, you see, convincing evidence to, you know, I think, an increasing number of people. All right. Now, Ralph doesn't say, you know, just sit tight and everything will work out. She doesn't advocate any kind of fatalism about this. She has five or six, I guess it's seven things here, seven pieces of concrete advice as to what to do about this. One, don't owe your soul to the Antichrist. In other words, reduce your financial transactions. I'm not sure that people who control finances are the Antichrist. I'm sure if there are any bankers here, they wouldn't, or insurance people, they wouldn't probably feel too happy about that. But anyway, reduce your financial transactions. In other words, don't let the Antichrist have more control over you than, you know, he already does. You know, like, sold, what's that old Tennessee Ernie Ford song, sell your soul to the company store? You know, mine 16 tons, all right. Anyway, secondly, pay all the debts that you can. Third, pay off your mortgage if you have savings sufficient. It'll be a long time before that happens, you know, in my world. But anyway, pay off your mortgage. Buy an acre of land out of the city. Put a tent, trailer, or cottage there. Raise a garden, learn to can or preserve, dig a well, live independently of city conveniences. Otherwise, you'll be dependent on, you know, public sewer and public water and all the rest of these things. So, in my part of the country, this would be Northern States Power Company. That's something, I'm not sure they're demonic, but sometimes I wonder. All right. Five, give abundantly to the Lord's work. Six, pray for guidance to know on what to convert your liquid assets. 7, get into the explicit will of God, he will, you know, he will persevere. All right, now, how is that going to be enforced? And here she goes beyond, and then I'll just mention this one last one without editorial comment, and then you can see. It's going to be enforced through television. It's going to be enforced through television. Everybody will have a television set. They are already in our homes. We don't have to wait for 1984 with Big Brother, you know, it's already there. You might have some feelings about television, you know, for the big boob tube and time waster and all the rest, but she has other ideas about television. We obviously think it's, for all practical purposes, something of a convenience, but she says that televisions will monitor our lives because we have to work through the television to punch in all our financial transactions, and it will store it. It'll record it, and it'll be there for the Antichrist to use against us. And you say, well, you've got, what, 225 billion people? Or how many? How many? 225 million Americans. It's 2 billion some number of people in the world. I don't have to forget how many there are. Four now? Good heavens, it's increased since I did my research here.
Every few years.
No, I did this over spring break, so... things have picked up, and that was...
Chinese are busy.
You're right, the follow-up predicted overpopulation, that's right, you remember? All right, anyway, how can, you know, 4 billion, how can this handle, you know, the total financial transactions of over 4 billion people? It's through what she calls fiber optics, a tiny glass thread, 80 times lighter than earlier copper wire, which has a much larger information transference capacity. And so therefore, she sees fiber optics as the means of doing this. You see what she's doing? She's taking new technology, and she's trying to find some, you know, if you want to call it religious meaning to it. How does all this fit in? These aren't just gadgets, but obviously these are things to her which have to have some place in the eternal scheme of things. And she reads, you know, cosmic significance into fiber optics. I'm sure those who have stocks in fiber optics are very happy about it because I'm sure they're doing well on the market, but you know, I'm not sure they have cosmic significance. All right. Now, then the last part here, I want to turn to this and then we'll have time for discussion. You know, what does it matter? Does it really matter? I mean, you have some people writing things like this. You've always had some people who are willing. What was it, P.T. Barnum? Said there's a sucker born every minute, wasn't it? And so on. But does it really matter? I would like to say, yes, it really does matter for about 5 or 6 reasons that I think are really very important. For one thing, I think what the whole attitude towards, you know, the end times are in this particular scheme really is the beginning, not only the beginning, but the carrying out of, I think, a rather dangerous anti-intellectualism in the country. Because what they are really saying is that technological progress is the work of the Antichrist. That this kind of technological progress is the work of the Antichrist. And therefore, we should be very skeptical and dubious about certain kinds of technological progress, because although we might think that computers will make our lives easier, for instance, and I'm not talking here about weaponry, that's a whole different category altogether, but we'll be talking about that perhaps tonight. But I'm talking about something like computers, and now if that's the work of the Antichrist, then obviously we should be very skeptical about this, and I think that perhaps is a significant step backwards. Myself, because technology, it depends on how it's used, and therefore, people like the people who were at my adult forum have all kinds of questions because they don't know quite what to say to those who feel that, you know, for instance, computers are the work of the Antichrist. I think a second thing, and going into this in no particular order of significance, except for my last point, will be that the popularity of this, you know, attitude towards the end times really is a severe setback, really, to what I call the great educational teaching ministry of the church itself. The church has many functions, obviously, and one of the great functions of the church is that of education. The Catholics call this the magisterium, or the teaching authority, really, of the church itself. And in the Christian faith, we have great traditions of great teachers, starting after the apostolic age, anyway, starting, for instance, with St. Augustine, or with St. Thomas Aquinas, or with Luther, or with Calvin, Knox, you know, Zwingli, the Wesleys. You know, you can name the great leaders and the teachers in the church, and they are there for our edification. One of the most exciting experiences I've had in my teaching has been the last 2 years we've had what really is a great books program at our college, And I've started right off, you know, from Homer to Freud, and getting back to the great classics again has been very rewarding, very interesting. And what the end times, these kinds of end times people are saying, is that we can find the great answers in a kind of, I think, a razzle-dazzle, sensationalist, instant gratification kind of explanation. And simply ignore the great tradition, the great legacies, which we have. I know not everybody is going to sit down after a hard day's work and read The City of God, for instance, because it's a very difficult and a very challenging and sometimes obscure work. But it's there, and it's there for, I think, for our edification. And I would be reluctant really to lose that altogether. All right. I think another point that I would like to make by way of comment is, as to what does it matter, is I think our, I'd put it this way as a question. Does our faith require going to the newspapers, going to the radio, going to the television, listening to some new tragedy and disaster, and then going to Scripture to find out where that's foretold? I think this is, you see, where Lindsay makes a mistake. He looks at what's happened, especially since 1948, after the second great fulfillment of their time, and he is saying God's action in the world is to be found in the unfolding of daily events, in some sort of scenario, you see, that's already been accepted. And my own feeling here is one which I want to quote from a professor of New Testament at Luther Northwestern, Roy Harrisville, and he says this, and he's talking about Lindsay. What emerges is not a lucid portrayal of God's redemptive action in Jesus Christ the Lord. What emerges is not a lucid portrayal of God's redemptive action in Jesus Christ the Lord, but the capricious government of a man, capricious judgment of a man intent on reading God's mind, come hell or high water, from out of the daily newspaper. You see, that's the point, that you have to find God at work in the daily newspaper, or otherwise maybe God isn't there, maybe God isn't in control, and every time there is some disaster, I forget the name of the little town in California. Yeah, and then in Japan recently, and so on. That's aha. That's further proof. Dan Erlander would call that aha, I guess. So all right. And another point that Harrisville makes, which I think is certainly worth considering very seriously and is fundamental, is that Lindsay and the others do not see that the coming of Christ in the New Testament was the complete fulfillment, you see, of the Old Testament prophets. The statements of Daniel and Ezekiel were relevant for their day. But Christ is the new creation, the hope of the life to come, the new creation. Christ means the Old Testament prophecies have been fulfilled, the new creation is here. And if you can believe, for instance, that Daniel, who wrote in the 6th century BC, was writing for the world since 1948, you have a way of interpreting the scripture which, is, I think, rather difficult to defend. All right. Another one which I like very much of the explanation or the rebuttals here. There are those who say, and I think, being in Holden, this is a very good place to say that, we can find the hand of God in the natural world and in the everyday flow of events, the world of the seasons, the flow of the world as well as in the flow of national world, local events itself. If we, the point is this, if we want to see the real signs of God in the natural world, we look to the natural wonders. We look to, God's design in nature. For instance, I come from southern Minnesota, and it was a slow spring so far as moisture and all the rest was concerned. But I'm sure, the farmers, that is that a sign? You think somebody's sending us a sign that a bee is here? That I usually know what to do in these cases, but it's been a while. See who he's attracted to here.
Okay.
Maybe somebody had that syrup from the egg caca that we're looking at. All right. Anyway, here's one of God's natural wonders that I can do without for a little while. The farmer in January looks at his field and knows that in 6-7 months, the crop will be flourishing there. He knows that simply because God has provided it. The fields will be blooming. That where God is found in nature, there will be steady providential care. And so therefore, what I'm trying to say is that it does matter that we find God, where God is really to be found, not in the bizarre, not in the rare, not in the unusual. But God in, the everyday flow of matters itself. All right, now let me take another one about, what does it matter? Okay, if, for instance, you have a friend to whom you want to introduce the Christian faith, somebody who is, simply hasn't had the background, you want to introduce a friend to the faith, to evangelize, to tell the good news. would you do it according to some sort of scheme of numerology? You want some sort of scheme of proof texts? Would you do it with all the business that God has to be proven in light of, you know, all the things that we're talking about here? In other words, let me just raise the question without the answer here. What would be the best way, the way you find the closest to you, for conveying the good news of Christ, you see, for the living encounter with Christ, you know, to a friend? Well, you do it through, a way which I've been talking about, or will you probably do it another way? All right. I think, and then I talked about the business of foreign policy here. And my last point would be, you know, do we really believe that the God of the tradition of the premillennialists is the God we really believe in? A God who allowed the things, for instance, in Ezekiel to happen. Is that the God who makes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust? The shepherd who leaves the 99 and goes for the one stray? The father who welcomes the prodigal, the God who sent his son? It seems hard to believe in a God who would visit on the world a tribulation, worse than anything which has been known up until this time. And then a sort of a positive ending here. To be a Christian means to live in the confidence that God has already intervened in history, setting loose in the life and death and resurrection of Christ all the transforming power the world needs. And I always like a quotation or a quip that Martin Marty made as a way of concluding, and he says that Hal Lindsey gave up on the world before God did. I invite your comments, criticisms. Some people may be glad to disagree, and I'd be glad to do that.
The Antichrist, do you take that to be a person or some sort of a power?
It's a very difficult kind of concept that I'm not ready to say can be understood in terms of what we have seen in history already. There's no question, we've talked about this in the earlier part of the week, about the pervasiveness of evil in the world. And that it's not just an individual thing, but it is the powers and the principalities. And we've had some good discussions on that. If I'm not right on that, Joel, because we've been at the same sessions, please.
Yeah. Earlier, you mentioned earlier the danger of having a Secretary of State who believes we simply must have a war to get God's show on the road.
Right.
I think it's not just a Secretary of State, but I have sometimes wondered, and this is my own personal opinion, I've never read this anywhere, but I've wondered if that's the motivation that's behind James Watt in raping the environment, is that we might as well use it up because it's not going to be here. So this could be in not just in the Secretary of State, but it could be, you know, many places in our government.
Yep.
Go ahead and use it up because the show's going to be all over pretty soon. And so
and that's why I use that quotation, that famous or if you like infamous quotations of Watt before the House Interior Committee.
Yeah, he acts like, you know, there's not going to be very much time, so let's just go ahead and cut the force down. And
so that's what I was getting to the point. It does matter. Yeah.
How many other people does Watt have a strong following? Do a lot of people in the government feel that way?
Well,
are they making themselves known or not?
He's won every time, except no, he hasn't won every time. He was going to put for sale signs along the Pacific Coast, wasn't it? And lost on that one. And he has been stymied. Where was the last one? He was stymied. He won on the Montana coal, even though he undersold. He lost the government about $100 million. And in a fire sale, the government could have done much better in the sales there. But that's the question, Joe. That's frightening. If you do it in with that particular motivation in mind,
he's doing what the president
told him. Yeah, and there's always talk and speculation, and politics is this kind of politics is always wide open to reconsideration. But my friends in Washington, everybody has their own friends in Washington, but my friends in Washington, I was talking to somebody about this before this session today, say that obviously Watt has become a political liability, and RP is back, all right?
I think he is.
And somebody got...
Watt, obviously.
Watt wants to disrupt our concentration here.
Don't
panic. But anyway, the talk is that he's become a liability. The Beach Boys thing was the last sort of fiasco, you know, foot and mouth disease. And that he'll be dead about 2 months before the election, as evidence that Reagan is serious about getting rid of him. Yeah.
Maybe so, but he's still the most popular speaker at Republican fundraisers.
Yeah, very, very popular.
I think you can take this, doesn't matter, to a more everyday type of experience, too. I had an employee who was a teacher real estate classes and courses, and he told me several occasions that night he was really happy that Reagan won, and he was really ecstatic when he thought that Russia was going to invade Poland, And he was convinced that 1985, that was it. And it was impossible to motivate him to do anything. So that the last thing I had to do was to fire him. And it didn't bother him once
that. That's good.
I like that. We've got a fly swatter. Is there a fly swatter in the house?
Bill. In the LCU, there's a new Bible study series. You may be familiar with the Word and Witness program.
Word and Witness, okay.
And one segment of that deals with the interpretation of prophecy, which, from my perspective, would put all of these questions to rest immediately.
Sure.
That being the prophecy in the in both Daniel and Revelation and all has to be seen totally in the context of its day and its setting, which is just a spokesman for God amidst the difficult times.
Right.
Now, the tragedy that I sense is that within our Lutheran communities, they're really, we ourselves are not biblically literate at that point, and we're still dealing off the old definitions of prophecy, being fortune-telling, future predicting, and all that. And therefore, if we had that question clear, all the rest of these in our circles,
There's a real need there. We've got a couple of books out. One, a professor of religion at Luther, Richard Hansen, tried to answer Lindsay, and it just didn't quite work. Don Steen's book is good, but it doesn't quite work. Bill and then...
I think there's another dimension that complements this concern of the future, and that can be seen in microcosm in our church, which is facing some difficult financial times and faced a big deficit, and yet the roof leaks. So what do we do? Well, there was a proposal that we dip into the principle of trust funds. And of course, the church was very divided on this. And part of the church said, oh yes, well that's what the trust funds are for. In times, these are very difficult times, in times of stress and emergency, we should be willing to dip. And another group said, no, those are sacrosanct, that we can't touch them. And I wonder if, in a sense, as the nation becomes more and more convinced that these are exceptional times, therefore we should be willing, as Watt is willing, to exploit our natural resources now, because this is a crisis time, and we should be willing now to dip into our principle of talent and funds to build up our military, because this is a crisis time. If that type of thinking and that type of approach and philosophy comes up with political, economic, and military strategies which are akin to what end-time people think, coming at it from an entirely different direction.
Yeah.
So you may have quite a large constituency that supports the policy.
Yeah, that's. I think it is. It makes sense to a lot of people, and therefore what they need is a very strong leader at the helm. Joel, then.
The thing is, we should all live so that we are in the presence of the Lord every day. I may drop dead of a heart attack before I get over there to lunch. And that, for me, will be the end time.
Yeah.
So I don't know why people get so upset.
Well, I think it's a way of needing to validate their faith.
Yeah.
Which needs specific, concrete, tangible proof. You remember the old one, the Jews wanted a miracle and the Greeks wanted an argument. And some people need that kind of validation. It's hard to live with ambiguity.
But they spoke fear.
And so very much they're fearful, right? And they need to believe that that God is completely in control, that everything that happens fits into a very neat plan, that there are no loose ends. And the need for security. And it's obvious in history that when there have been times like plagues and droughts and famines and all the rest, interest in the end times obviously increases. Cohen's book shows that very well. And I think that's obviously where we're at now.
As Erling alluded earlier, I'm a computer systems analyst. Okay, I'm one of those
evil
antichrist type people. I've worked in the largest civilian-owned computer installation west of the Mississippi River. And around the year 2000, I'm going to be taking a sabbatical because the biggie is going to be teaching those computers to figure out that we've changed the millennium.
There's another computer person over there watching.
Financially speaking, just about every program in existence has a two-digit year date. Okay, and now how are you going to tell the difference between 19-something and 2000-something? And this is already starting to cause such a tizzy in the computer field that they're going to be so worried trying to figure that thing out that they aren't going to have time to take us over in the year 2000.
It'll be blown up. Of course, then you get into that interesting question, is the new millennium actually going to be the year 2000 or the year 2001? Isn't that the completion of the 1990s? How can you start with anything except, you know, one? That's just a silly point.
What about, if you're just talking about academic arguments, too, the whole ABBC thing, came into existence in 421 or so, when someone decided that 90s should decide to count backwards, and that right. Really, if anyone were to ask in his day when Jesus was born, when he says something like, 759 from the founding of Rome, 749 from the founding of Rome. The whole year by year, if you just take a look at the calendars, the whole thing falls apart at that point because there is no such thing as a fixed timing system.
But with numerology, it has its attraction because it offers symmetry and predictability. And a lot of people, you know, quite rightly, are very scared about the future. And therefore, if they can hang on to something, and numbers, you know, is very, very popular. And if you can get a scheme, it's like why people bet at the racetrack. They find, you know, a scheme that works. Let me give you my classic example. The one and only time I went to a Greyhound racetrack in Denver, right? And I didn't know anything about it, but I knew how the daily double was. So my birthday dates are 1 and 3. So on the first two races, I bet 1, and sure enough, number 1 won on the first. Boy, I've got something going here. And then on number 3, I was sure was going to win. His name was Henry Clay, and I teach American history. And Henry Clay is a three-time candidate for the presidency. I thought, somebody's sending me a message, you know. And then number 3, you know, came in on a walk, but all the other doors were running. And so that took care of my numerology. But people, you know, like that sort of thing.
They used numbers in the Old Testament quite a bit, too.
Yes.
That's rather interesting.
Yeah, right. But it's when you find there's a cosmic meaning to them, that's a predictability that's always right, that you can think in terms just of 3 or think in terms just of 7 or whatever it is. That's what frightened me. So gamblers would be the best examples of you know, people who believe in numerology. And that's, you know, it offers a kind of security. And, you know, it's just like, it comes very close to astrology, really. Yeah.
The one that I like was walking through one of these bookstores, you know, LNG type rack there, and they had this one cover that had the pricing that, you know, at the store where you sit through. That was on the big cover. It said, "This is the mark of the beast." And when I turned it over on the other side, they had the little one so they could use it to sell the book.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, then we'll, one or two more, and then many of you have been here since 9 o'clock. So.
A good bit of scripture that's sometimes lost on this is, you know, neither the day nor the hour.
Right, thief in the night, right.
Yeah.
And you know, we can make jokes, and some of it is a little funny and so on, but it does indicate, and I like what you said so much, that there is a real need for, you know, greater understanding, because when people don't understand, they will oftentimes, you know, go into that which is a little more sensational, a little more, you know, easy to understand. And that's where I think, that's where I got excited about this, when I found out there was so much misunderstanding about this. Yes?
Perhaps we need to go back to a child. When our son was 9 years old, he ordered a battery-operated hand warmer for going skiing. Mm-hmm. Then he went to Sunday school, and I was the teacher. Somebody brought up the subject of the Second Coming, and we talked about it and decided that the thing to do was that we should live each day in our Christian life, then we would be ready. And our son sighed and said, "Well, that's fine with me, but I sure hope he waits until after the hand warmer comes."
Okay, well, why don't we just put on that happy note? And anybody who has anything, you know, to talk about, just please come up, sure.
Well, I was just going to say that I've come to the conclusion that the Lord is, as long as people are predicting when the Lord's going to come back, we don't have to be concerned about him coming back, because of the scripture that Bill referenced, and because the Lord isn't going to give a human being the opportunity to say, "Aha, I told you so."
It is a little bit, you know, curious that God has chosen just this generation to tell them when all this is going to happen.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, other generations have tried, but they're gone.
Yeah. Okay.
We're here.